Hey there, it's Captain Roger of the Grass Valley Corps of the Salvation Army. Grace and peace to each and every one of you today. Thank you so much for joining us here. You know, I spent a couple of days last week teaching first aid and CPR classes. And after 2 days of training classes, we have 19 newly certified CPR providers and one new first aid CPR trainer. So the world is at least a little bit safer than it was before I helped pass that information on, which is great. The central principle of CPR is that we need to breathe in oxygen and have it circulate freely through our body in order to be alive. Anything that takes away from or stops that breath circulating through our bodies is a danger to our lives that needs to be dealt with. That even means that if someone has stopped breathing, we can and should give them what we call rescue breaths, where we use our own breath to breathe air into them. The compressions that get done to someone's chest, that's a way to force their heart to push that blood carrying the air through the body to keep life coursing through it. Now, just as breathing oxygen in keeps us alive, we are meant to breathe in life from God so that we can live and share that life with those around us. And as we take up our journey through the book of Acts today, at Acts chapter 4, verse 32, I'm going to walk you through what I mean in hopes that you will be willing to begin offering a little divine CPR to the world. All right? And we're going to start with just a single verse that says a lot more than most people realize it does. And that is, like I said, Acts chapter 4, verse 32. It says, "All the believers were one in heart and mind. No one claimed that any of their possessions was their own, but they shared everything they had." Man, take note of this first part about the believers being one. They were one in heart, which in those days, that was the heart. That was thought to be the seat of your will, your intellect. To say that they were one in heart was like saying that they were one in their thoughts and intentions, or at least they were trying to be. This is another one of those things that was all about choice and action, not about feelings the way we associate things with the heart now. Our New International Version translation that I'm using today, it also says that they were one in mind. Most other English translations use the word soul here. The Greek word hiding underneath these translations of mind or soul is actually the word psuche. Psuche, it means the thing that makes something alive. It's most often and best translated as breath. They were one in breath. In the Greek version of the Hebrew scriptures called the Septuagint, when God calls for the earth to bring forth living creatures back in the beginning, this is the word that he uses, psuche, breath, creatures filled with breath, with life. And then in Genesis 2, verse 7, it says, "Then the Lord God formed a man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living being." It is the breath of God that gives us life, and the breath of God which sustains that life. We need to breathe God. Are y'all with me on that? Good. We need to get this so that we can understand the bigger picture of what's going on in the rest of the story here in Acts, all right? Acts chapter 4, again, verse 32. "All the believers were one in heart and mind. No one claimed that any of their possessions was their own, but they shared everything that they had. With great power, the apostles continued to testify to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and God's grace was so powerfully at work in them all that there were no needy persons among them. For from time to time, those who owned houses or land sold them and brought the money from the sales and put it at the apostles' feet, and it was distributed to anyone who had need. Joseph, a Levite from Cyprus, whom the apostles called Barnabas, which means son of encouragement, sold a field that he owned, and he brought the money and he put it at the apostles' feet." Now, we're going to pause here for a minute. What we have here is an elaboration on what Luke told us back in Acts chapter 2, verses 43 and 44. He said, "Everyone was filled with awe at the many wonders and signs performed by the apostles, and all the believers were together and had everything in common." And the word awe here is another one of those weird to translate words. In Greek, it's phobos. It's the word we get phobia from. It means to have a fear or a healthy respect for something. So what Luke was saying in Acts 2 is that the church, seeing signs from God being done at the request of believers in Jesus, they were struck by this fear and respect in such a way that it meant they held their possessions lightly and were willing to put them at the disposal of others to make sure that everyone was cared for. And in chapter 4, we're told that that means there were even people selling off property to give the leadership resources to meet the needs of their whole community. And that thing where it says that they put the money at the apostles' feet means that it was entrusted to them to care for and administer. If we'd been told they put the money in their hands, it would have meant that it was a personal gift for them to use as they see fit, but that's not it. People are not giving it to the apostles personally, they're giving it to the community and trusting the apostles to administer it wisely to help that community, all right? Which is what they seem to have been doing, because that first half of verse 34 said, there were no needy persons among them. Can you imagine that? There were no needy persons among them. That is so important. It's important because both, it shows them sharing life. They're breathing into each other in ways that keep them all alive and well. And it's important because this is a communal wellness thing. It's a sign that God's will is being done when that happens. There are no needy people among them. That says that God's will is being done. Now, how do I know that? I know that because back when God was leading his people out of slavery and death to the promised land of freedom and life, he made them a promise. This is from Deuteronomy chapter 15, verses 4 and 5. God told Moses, there need be no poor people among you, for in the land the Lord your God is giving you to possess as your inheritance, he will richly bless you, if only you fully obey the Lord your God and are careful to follow all these commands I am giving you today. Now, pretty much the entire of the covenant that God established through Moses, it was focused on explaining how people could live together in community. If they do, God promises he's provided them with abundance, so there will be more than enough for everyone to live and live well. Imagine for a moment what the world would be like if poverty was eliminated. How much crime is caused by desperate people trying to scrape up what it takes just to get by? How much do people take in drugs or alcohol as a way to kill the pain of a life where their real needs aren't met the way that they should be? How many wars are launched by people who think it's the only way for them to get what they or their people need? But if everyone had enough and then some and no more, would the ills perpetuated by poverty even exist anymore? A different life would be. That is the world that the believers in Jesus were trying to create. That is what they are trying to live out. This is a world represented by Barnabas, the son of encouragement. And what a great nickname that is. I mean, he must have been the kind of guy who just walked into a room and you felt better because he was there. My nickname was and is to some Cloak. It makes some people think of a warm cape sheltering them from the elements, but other people think of it as a wrap that holds shadows and darkness inside. Regrettably, I am not always the son of encouragement that we are shown as an example of what we can be. I'm working on it, right? Barnabas, he's like a breath of fresh air adding oxygen to the room. He's breathing the breath of God in his own life and becoming the breath of God in the lives of others. He's doing what we should all aspire to, breathing God, living God, sharing God, building others up as God's beloved children as we journey together in community. And it may seem difficult at first, but the more we practice, the easier it gets until it's as easy as, breathing. So what happens if we decide that somehow other people don't need to breathe quite so much as we do? Chapter 5, verse 1. Now, a man named Ananias, together with his wife Sapphira, also sold a piece of property. With his wife's full knowledge, he kept back part of the money for himself, but he brought the rest and put it at the apostles' feet. Then Peter said, Ananias, how is it that Satan has so filled your heart that you have lied to the Holy Spirit and kept some for yourself from the money you received for the land? Didn't it belong to you before it was sold? And after it was sold, wasn't the money at your disposal? What made you think of doing such a thing? You haven't just lied to human beings, but to God. All right, let's take just a moment and break down what's going on here, because this whole story can be a little weird, right? First, there was no rule that said anyone needed to sell their stuff. And there was no rule that said they needed to give anything to anyone or to the community. In fact, there's still no rule like that. Never has been, never will be. These seem to be things that some people in the community were choosing to do because they could help others by doing so. Right? If we're going to love our neighbors, we need to be willing to help them in any way we can. And what they're seeing is a way that they can help, and they're doing it. That's what Barnabas did. It seems to be what Ananias and Sapphira had initially intended to do. They sold a piece of property intending to give all that was raised to the community. But something changed. Maybe it was having that much money in their hands. Maybe they got more than they expected. Maybe they got less. Maybe they started thinking about those who would be helped, and they wondered if those people really needed to have so much. But I suppose the justification that they used to themselves isn't what matters. What matters is what they decided to do. The word, which says they kept back part of the money, it also means to hold on to something. It also means stole. They stole something. Now, does that seem harsh, saying that they stole the money that had been theirs from the sale of property that they had owned? Well, remember all that the story is telling us. They had pledged it all. Not part of it. They pledged all of it. And when Ananias gave it, after taking some of the pledged money for himself, he then said, "I'm giving it all." Now, sure, it had been his before, and the decision of what to give was his, but once he gave it, taking part of it back in this way, that's wrong. It's like he was going to give oxygen tanks for 10 people, but now he's only given 9, and the other one he brought home and left in his garage because he didn't really need it, he just wanted it. But what about the guy who needed that? Here, Ananias said, "Everything belongs to the cause." And then he took some for himself. Now, it was his to keep or to give in part or in whole, but to say that it was one thing and then do the other made it so that he was taking what was no longer his. You following that? He said, "I'm giving it all to you." And then he took a handful of it away secretly. And tried to keep that to himself and gave the rest. Peter tells him this is Satan filling his heart. Now remember the heart? That's the seat of intellect. It's your will, your intelligence, it's your mind. That's the way they thought those days. And in this context, being filled means to have been influenced or controlled by something. We see the same idea used elsewhere in the New Testament, like in Ephesians book 5, where Paul writes that believers should be filled with the Spirit, speaking to one another with psalms, hymns, and songs from the Spirit. Peter tells Ananias, "You've allowed the adversary to influence your decisions. Satan has convinced you to turn your promise to give into a lie by only giving part of what you said you would." Then that spirit convinced you and Sapphira to cover it up. Remember, they decided to steal this money together. It said he decided to keep back some money with his wife's full knowledge. So it was a planned lie. What they gave was a planned lie. And as Peter said, you haven't just lied to human beings, but to God. Verse 5. When Ananias heard this, he fell down and he died. And great fear seized all who heard what happened. And then some young men came forward, wrapped up his body, and carried him out and buried him. He died. He exuko. He released his last breath. And a great fear seized all who heard of it. I bet it did. It's the kind of thing that should give all of us pause, shouldn't it? Now, there's no statement that this is a miraculous death or God's punitive action against Ananias or a curse from Peter or anything like that. It's possible that he was just caught and shocked and it caused him to have a heart attack or something like that. Stress kills, after all. If you want to be more metaphysical about it, though, think of it this way. God is the source of life. We've been using the breath analogy. Think of the community breathing together. There is enough breath to sustain them all, but by his actions, Ananias had separated himself from the community. Maybe just a little, but separation is separation. And by separating himself from God's community, he is separating himself from God. He is cutting himself off from the breath of life. What happens when you can't breathe? What happens when the suko is not in you? You die. And when you convince others to stop breathing with you, what happens? Verse 7, about 3 hours later, his wife came in, not knowing what had happened. And Peter asked her, "Tell me, is this the price you and Ananias got for the land?" "Yes," she said, "that is the price." And Peter said to her, "How could you conspire to test the Spirit of the Lord? Listen, the feet of the men who buried your husband are at the door, and they'll carry you out also." And at that moment she fell down at his feet and died. And then the young men came in and, finding her dead, carried her out and buried her beside her husband. The breath of God in us. That's life. We breathe the breath of God to live and to share it and to share in that life. We are to breathe God. When we choose not to breathe, the result is predictable. I mean, what effect does this sharp and visible result have on the rest of the community? Look at verse 11. It says, "Great fear seized the whole church and all who heard about these events." Great fear. Megas phobos. This fear, this healthy respect, it took hold of the whole church. Something interesting, though. This is the very first time that the collected believers are referred to as the church, the ecclesia, the called out gathering or assembly. Something in this tragic loss of Ananias and Sapphira brought the community closer together. Now, it might just be fear, but I think there's something more, something deeper growing here, something that's turning them from a collection of people who believe in Jesus into a family, right? In the Proverbs, there's a saying that gets repeated in a number of places. One of them is at Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7. It says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction." And Proverbs chapter 9, verse 10 says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is understanding." Now, neither of these is about being afraid of God. It's about an understanding that there is something greater than ourselves that we are part of. And when we choose to separate ourselves from that, we lose more than a few coins or a chance to puff ourselves up as important or any other momentary reward that forgets we are made to be part of a whole, not superior to the other parts, not a standalone part that doesn't need the rest, but parts of a whole. We're not made to be a part that ignores or rejects the promise of God that when we trust in him, we'll be richly blessed and none will be poor. We're supposed to be part of that whole. The prophet Isaiah said, "Who among you fears the Lord and obeys the word of his servant? Let the one who walks in the dark, who has no light, trust in the name of the Lord and rely on their God. We should respect and be aware of the consequences of separating ourselves from the breath of life, even if we think we're just going to hold our breath for a moment, or that we're going to give up a single breath here or there. When we keep that in mind, it should make it easier for us to choose to keep breathing, to keep relying on God and His life for us, instead of cutting ourselves off from that. Breathe the breath of God and life, and by doing so, share that life with those around you. Just breathe. Are you with me? Now in CPR, we use rescue breaths to get oxygen into the lungs, and we use chest compressions to get blood moving to carry that life-giving breath through the body. As followers of Jesus, we are to breathe in the things of God, the breath of life, and then we are to live them out in a way that brings rescue breaths to the people around us. In all things, we need to remember to breathe God. Just breathe. If I could sing, I would lead us all in a round of Breathe on Me, Breath of God. It's an old hymn by Edwin Hatch. But since I sing like an off-key alley cat, let me read the first two verses of that hymn to wrap this up for us today. Breathe on me, breath of God. Fill me with life anew, that I may love the way you love and do what you would do. Breathe on me, breath of God, until my heart is pure, until my will is one with yours to do and to endure. Grace and peace to each and every one of you today and throughout this coming week. Wherever you go, remember, you have nothing to fear because God is already there. Just go with God. See y'all next time.